ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. If I were to start talking slowly and loudly, calling you dear and sweetheart, I'm guessing you wouldn't take it too kindly. Talking to an older person like this has a name. It's called elder speak. And it's just part of the ageism a lot of older Australians face, especially when they're trying to get healthcare. In the next 20 minutes, new research into experiences of older people being dismissed and excluded from decisions. Also ahead, there are a lot of words I'm not allowed to say on the radio. But the list has shifted over the years. There are some words I'd probably get away with now, and others that might have been fine a few decades ago that absolutely would not fly today. Why the change? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, the only truly safe way to avoid a bad drug experience is to never touch drugs in the first place. And yeah, in theory, that sounds great. But with Schoolies Week rolling in, we all know what's about to happen. A lot of teenagers are going to experiment whether we like it or not. And across Australia, more and more doctors, harm reduction workers, and health advocates are saying that when it comes to drug use, just say no isn't enough. They argue that harm prevention, meeting young people where they're actually at, is far more realistic than preaching abstinence. And that's where pill testing comes in. It was even available at Schoolies in 2024, but not this year. The Queensland government has taken a firm stance against it, pulling the service entirely. So if you're a parent and your teenager is heading to the Gold Coast for Schoolies, does that make you nervous? You're about to hear from a drug checking service provider who was responsible for the trial site at Schoolies on the Gold Coast last year, and a 19-year-old who plans on using pill testing at a music festival this weekend. But first, Jenny Ross King understands just how critical it is to get the conversation about drugs with your kids right. Jenny, welcome back to Life Matters.
Hi, Tegan. Thanks for having me again.
So, Jenny, you lost your daughter Alex to a drug overdose in 2019. Do you mind telling that story?
Yeah, sorry. Never gets easier.
I'm sorry.
Alex consumed MDMA tablets in 2019 after seeing drug detection dogs. So she'd consumed two tablets as entering into the festival. She had already consumed one about an hour beforehand, and she overheated. Obviously didn't know what was going on. Her friends didn't know what was going on, and she didn't come home.
Jenny, you've told this story so many times over the last 6 years, and I can just still hear how raw it is for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It doesn't change. It was just so unnecessary and preventable. And it breaks my heart that, you know, potentially someone else's child could go, you know, they could go through this too. And it doesn't have to be like that.
What do you want to have happen?
Wow. So much. I mean, pill testing is, I think, obviously one area that, you know, needs to happen. Young people need somewhere to go and speak to a health professional. You've got Cameron on the show in a little while, and he'll be able to go through all the positives of all that. And, you know, I think if Alex had access to a service like that on the day, she would have used it, most definitely.
That may have given
her more insight as to what was happening to her and her body. And she may be here today with me, supporting, you know, further information and education for young people.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to ask. What could she have known about what she was taking at the time?
Not very much. She had screenshots on her phone of effects and things like that, but she really, you know, her and her friends had experimented before, but not not in that environment. I mean, it was a 35, 37 degree day in Parramatta Park, very little shelter and shade. So it was just, it was the perfect storm for something to go wrong. There was, I think it was 11 or 10 other kids that went to hospital that night. Alex was just the only one that didn't come home.
Oh, my gosh. What kind of conversations had you had together before that?
Oh, look, honestly, nothing that I would have today. I didn't experiment with drugs when I was younger, and Alex knew that. So I really had no credibility whatsoever with her. I didn't know where to go to look for the information. I wouldn't have even known what drugs to even begin to research to be able to have a decent conversation. It was the abstinence, drugs are bad for you. Firstly, they're illegal. They're illegal for a reason. Like all the things that generally, the general people sort of say to their young person, like, don't take drugs. They can kill you and all this sort of stuff. But young people, nothing bad's going to happen. Youth gives them this perception that they're going to live forever. So when they do things that potentially are not good for their health, then they don't think about dying, most certainly not when it comes to recreational drugs. They're doing it to have a good time.
Jenny, it's so awful that the reason why you're so well informed and passionate today is because you lost your daughter over it. Cameron Francis is trying to help people head them off at the pass a bit more. CEO of The Loop, which is a drug checking service provider operating in New South Wales, Victoria, and previously in Queensland. Cameron, welcome to Life Matters.
Morning, Tegan.
We heard Jenny's story just now. Alex took a drug that's pretty common with young people, MDMA. What do we know about how common this is at an event like Schoolies, which is happening from this weekend?
Yeah, look, I just want to firstly acknowledge Jen's loss and all the other families around the country that have lost their young people and family members to drugs and drug overdose. We know that at events like Schoolies and similar kinds of music events, drugs like MDMA are really common. It's obviously tricky to know exactly how common it is, but I know that when we engaged with young people at Schoolies Week last year, I mean, we spoke to more than 1,000 schoolies and we were out hitting the streets and, a very large proportion of those were telling us that they were planning on using drugs. And, we also were sort of picking up from those young people that most of them were really inexperienced as well, and that either, used only a couple of times before and some had never used drugs before, but they were telling us that they were planning on doing that while they were at school.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Cameron Francis, who's the CEO of the national drug checking service, The Loop, and Jenny Ross King, who's become a drug harm prevention advocate after her daughter's overdose death in 2019. The Gold Coast, the site of one of the biggest Schoolies events in the country, is no longer going to have drug checking there after having the service last year on trial. The Queensland government shut it down entirely. On the text line, Anna says, those against drug testing need to understand it doesn't stop drug consumption, nor does it encourage it. It simply tells the potential user what they've actually got and what might happen if they take it. Jude says, I have a 17-year-old. He is a fabulous human, adventurous, and no doubt he'll experiment with drugs. My younger one, probably not. Jude says, no way is he going to Queensland for Schoolies. We'll support him to experiment in a safer environment. Cameron, what are your concerns about the lack of drug checking services on the Queensland's Gold Coast this year?
Look, I think experience last year, as I said, was that we realised that most of those young people have very little drug education. Some of the young people that we were speaking to, they were telling us about some of the education they were getting in schools or not getting in schools, and even like some really simple information that we were providing to people. Our real focus was explaining the risks of overdose of MDMA, and particularly the signs and symptoms of MDMA overdose and what that might look like and when to get help and where help is available. And what we were hearing from the schoolies was that, you know, they just wish someone had told them some of that information sooner. Their understandings of things like drug overdose had often come from the movies, or it had come from things their friends had told them, and a lot of that wasn't true. And, you know, explaining the signs and symptoms of overdose on a drug like MDMA is actually quite straightforward. It's really easy to explain that. And the young people, they want that information. They want people to have honest conversations with them because they want to stay safe with their friends as well. So they're hungry for the information, and I think it's up to us to really make sure we can provide that to them.
I will say we did invite the Queensland Health Minister, Tim Nicholls, onto the program. He wasn't available, but his team provided us with a statement. A Queensland Health spokesperson said, "There is no safe way to take drugs. Taking drugs is dangerous and can have dire consequences. We encourage young people going to schoolies to stay safe and take care of their friends. Ensuring the health and safety of young people at major events is very important. That's why Queensland Health will continue to deliver alcohol and other drug prevention, early intervention and harm reduction responses, as well as a suite of specialist alcohol and other drug treatment services across Queensland." And we will put the full statement on the ABC Radio National's website. Cameron, what do you make of this abstinence argument?
I mean, I find it really disappointing. It's like we're back in the 80s again. We know that politicians making statements about, like, you shouldn't take drugs is not effective. No lives are saved by the health minister making those kinds of statements. We know that despite our best efforts to try to prevent drug use, people do make the decision to use drugs, and particularly in environments like schoolies. Harm reduction responses are there when our other responses have failed. And that includes our supply reduction responses, our demand reduction responses. When that has failed, what we need to do is to keep people safe and to help them make better decisions. And for a lot of young people, drug use is a transitory sort of thing that they do while they're young. And they, you know, make decisions that when they're older, they may not make. And what we want to do is keep them safe through that period of time and keep everyone alive.
But, I mean, in that statement, they argue that they are providing harm reduction programs, that there's information, there's a Safer Schoolies program on their website. Do you think those are sufficient?
No, it's really not sufficient. I know that they use the words harm reduction, but the reality is that the schoolies' response in Surfers Paradise is a very strong police-led response. We found young people very scared of accessing our service because there's significant policing operations happening in Surfers Paradise, which makes young people really scared to come forward to have conversations about drugs. So while they may say those kinds of words, the reality is really different. And the experience of young people at schoolies is really different. They do not feel that they're in a safe and supportive environment to talk about drugs. There's a very heavy, obvious police presence. There's a lot of messaging to schoolies about being arrested for drugs. And so that really does create quite an unsafe environment.
I'm interested to hear a bit more about what you found last year. It was sort of a trial that the Loop did at schoolies on the Gold Coast. What kind of messages were you hearing from the kids, and what were you hoping to do this year?
Look, what we were hearing from the schoolies was that they were super reluctant to come into our service. I mean, they were being searched, they were being wandered for weapons across the Surfers Paradise precinct. And a lot of those wanding operations would lead to a pat-down search. And for a lot of young people, that's really scary. And if they've got drugs on them, we know young people were getting arrested for drugs secondary to a wanding search, which was looking for things like knives. So that sort of had that unintended consequence, I think, of making young people reluctant to access. But the young people we were speaking to, though, I mean, like 80% of them had never spoken to a health professional about alcohol and drugs before. About 90% of the people that came to the service had only used drugs a couple of times before, and even a few of them had never used drugs before at all. So they're incredibly naive audience who are really inexperienced, and that makes them at much more risk of drug-related harm when they're so inexperienced. So we also found that the people that came into the service were really susceptible to the information we were providing. We got about half of the people that came into our service told us that they would use a lower dose of drugs after accessing the service. And that's because our staff have explained the risks of overdose to them. And those young people, because they are a little bit more inexperienced, are really receptive to those messages. They want to hear it, and we're able to deliver that in an honest way, in a really authentic way that they take on board. So it was really successful at changing the behaviour of the people that came in. What we were hoping to do this year was to expand the service. I mean, last year was a real challenge because of an election happened 2 weeks before our service operated, which made it really uncertain as to whether we would go ahead or not. So we didn't get great communications with the schoolies to let them know that we were there. So this year what we would have done is massively expand those communications and make sure that every schoolie, before they even get to Service Paradise, know that we're there. We would have expanded our opening hours as well, so we could be open much longer. We only had a very limited period that we could operate in. And we'd also probably work more closely with police around understanding how it is that some of those policing practices can impact on health and help-seeking behaviour from young people, and how we can best kind of balance those two needs to make sure there are no weapons in the precinct, but also to make sure that young people feel safe to get help for drugs if they need it.
So, Jenny, we're about to hear from a 19-year-old who is planning to take recreational drugs at a festival where pill testing will be available. Without the schoolies example, there are many more drug testing services around than there used to be. Jenny, do you feel hopeful that teenagers can get better information about the drugs they're taking than Alex was able to?
I really do. I really hope so. I mean, you know, it's certainly improved over the last 6 years after the inquest and after, advocates have been coming forward and so on. So I do believe that it will improve. But I just, you know, it's politicians taking this moral ground over a health approach. I'm lost for words that, you know, the Queensland government did what they did. They did it before any sort of reporting and data came out. They basically just did it because their moral compass suggested that, we can't do that because it encourages drug taking, which is, you know, there is no evidence that suggests that. And Cameron said all that and very articulately. They're the ones that are talking to these young people. They're the ones that are explaining all these things. And, you know, I mean, for the short period that they were open, I have no doubt in my mind that they saved every single life that walked into that service.
Jenny, what's your final message to parents?
Well, I guess it comes back to that moral compass that, you know, don't let their personal moral compass get in the way of allowing their child access to information that could save their lives or someone else's.
On the text line, one person says, "Hi, Tegan. I have 16-year-old kids, so this has been discussed. I had a lot of experience in recreational drugs in my 20s. Today's drugs are cut with more fatal things, so this pill testing is great. More importantly, symptoms, what to look out for, stick with your mates, never wander alone, what to mix with what and the order to take drugs and alcohol. Importantly, never be afraid to ask for help. Saying no is like sticking your head in the sand." Well, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. You've been hearing from Jenny Ross King, who's a drug harm prevention advocate now after her daughter's overdose death in 2019, and Cameron Francis, who's CEO of national drug checking service The Loop. But schoolies isn't the only place where pill testing has been trialled. In New South Wales, a 12-month trial is underway at different locations, and one of them is Strawberry Fields, a music festival that's happening this weekend. And I got to speak to Sophia earlier. She's a 19-year-old who is planning to take recreational drugs at the festival, but she'll be seeking out the drug checking service first.
I definitely will be using the pill testing. I haven't actually used any of the pill testing services before. I want to make sure that I am fully aware of what I'm actually going to be putting into my body. I know someone who took something that she thought was something and then found out it was something completely different, which was very scary for her. And I think ever since that happened, we've been talking about it a bit more, I think. If I found out that what I was planning on taking was not what it was advertised as, or then I would definitely not take them, because I don't know the effects that can happen. I would definitely be very interested to know how different drugs interact. I know personally, I've only found out recently, and my friends have only found out recently, that certain things you are not supposed to mix with alcohol, and we always did. And finding out what can happen and what does happen is scary, and now we know not to do that. And I would definitely like to know what drugs you are not supposed to mix. I don't think that, you know, offering pill testing at Strawberry has encouraged any of my friends to take drugs. I don't think that that has changed their decision or, you know, encouraged them to do something that they weren't going to do otherwise. As much as we can hope that people are not going to take drugs at festivals or just in general, people are going to. That is just a fact. And I think that pill testing just allows people to be safer about it and be more educated about it. And, you know, can help people make smarter choices and actually save lives, honestly.
So that's Sophia, 19-year-old, going to Strawberry Fields Music Festival this weekend. On the text line, one person says, as a mother of a 17-year-old son who won't be at schoolies, it really bothers me that the ABC appears to be normalising drug use in teens. It's not normal. It's illegal. I agree with no testing. Where does this end? Who runs it and who manages it? And how can testing do anything else but encourage illegal backyard drug operations and importing? Sadly, this person says, abstinence is the only safe way. A 17-year-old is surely able to understand the concept of risk and the Russian roulette of taking drugs from a street seller. Please don't think most teens want to experiment with illegal drugs. There are plenty who don't and won't because they understand the risks. Cameron, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, and I think it's probably true. There probably are a large number of young people who are not going to use drugs, and that's great. What we're there to do is to keep the ones who do make the decision to use drugs safe and to give them with accurate information about what they're consuming and what the risks might be. We are essentially the ambulance at the top of the cliff. We're the very last step that we've got if someone has drugs literally in their pocket that they are intending to take that day. That's what a drug checking service is there to do, is to be that very last ambulance at the top of the cliff to stop people from, you know, we can prevent people taking drugs. I mean, about 14% of people who came through our fixed site drug checking service threw their drugs in the bin after speaking with one of our staff. So we definitely don't encourage drug use. We know that we actually reduce drug use by explaining the risks to people and helping them make better decisions.
It doesn't give them a false sense of security to get the drugs tested, walk away thinking it's safe and fine.
They walk away understanding the risks of drug use much better than they did before they came through the door. So our job and our staff are really skilled at doing this, is actually about explaining those risks to people in a way that is very personalised to them. It's delivered in a way that they comprehend and understand, and it's relevant for them and their friends. And so by doing that, those risks are really highlighted. And we definitely do not see people leaving the service thinking, high-fiving each other and how great it is. We definitely increase people's concerns and levels of anxiety about using drugs.
Where should parents or kids go for more information?
Look, I think there is some really good information online. The Alcohol and Drug Foundation has some great information. There's also Safe Sesh is a really great online resource as well that provides information about drugs. I think, you know, the most important thing I think for parents is to be really honest with their young people. A lot of parents, like Jen was saying, a lot of parents don't know about a lot of these different drugs, and you can't expect parents to know everything. But I think, you know, sitting down with your young person and having a conversation, asking them where they get their information from, and maybe having a look together. And there are some really great, you know, online resources out there, particularly both government and non-government organisations that work in alcohol and drugs, and have great info. So, yeah, really recommend parents check out, particularly Alcohol and Drug Foundation, ADF, website. They've got some resources there specifically aimed at parents to have that conversation with their young person.
Well, Cameron, Jenny, thank you both so much for joining me. Cameron Francis is CEO of the National Drug Checking Service, The Loop. Jenny Ross King became a drug harm prevention advocate after her daughter's overdose death in 2019. And you also heard from 19-year-old Sophia about how she and her friends feel about drug checking services. Thank you for your texts as well. Some real division on the text line. Kate says the Queensland government did say they'd cut out pill testing if they were voted in, and they did. People voted them in. Can the kids carry their own pill testers if they're choosing to take the option to take. Chris says pill testing saves lives, as do social media sites that advise of bad drugs being sold. Chris says, lost my beautiful niece to an overdose when she was partying with friends. Kids will experiment with drugs, at least minimise the harm. It's a no-brainer. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, because up next, we're told to respect our elders. So why is age discrimination so rife, especially in healthcare?
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Have you heard of elder speak? It's that kind of simple language or baby talk that people can often use when they're talking to older people. And it's really just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to talking about the discrimination that many older people face when they go to the doctor or find themselves in other healthcare settings. In a sec, you'll hear from the Age Discrimination Commissioner about new research into ageism in healthcare, which heard experiences of older people being dismissed, excluded from decisions, and treated as just a number. It found that perceptions of ageism are widespread across all levels of the health system, from how older people are treated by staff to broader systemic and policy issues. Well, Val Fell knows firsthand what it's like to be ignored or spoken down to. Val's in her 90s and is on the federal government's Aged Care Council of Elders. Val, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Do you find that people speak to you differently because you're older?
Oh, yes, yes. I've been experiencing this for many, many years. You know, people use a different language if they speak to you at all.
Interesting. So sometimes you're just spoken over. Sorry, I literally spoke over you to say that.
It's everywhere, in social settings, in the general public. You know, I can be out with somebody at a shopping centre, for example, and I'm with somebody else. So if I meet somebody whom I haven't seen for a while, they will speak to my daughter, for example, more than they will to me. And in fact, one lady even asked my daughter if I could still read. And in addition to that, if you go to a function at all, and this happened to me as well, and people will, the waiters at the table will treat you differently. They'll immediately assume, as one wine waiter did, that I would prefer to have a cup of tea than a glass of wine.
You're like, give me the wine, please.
The assumption is there, is once you are old, you are invisible.
So that would be very frustrating in a social setting, but it's really critical in a healthcare setting.
Oh, yes, yes, it is. I have experienced it where, you know, people who are supposed to be doing things for me will call me sweetie or darling or dear or love, you know, and that's a bit irky. Yeah, I'm nobody's darling, believe you me. You know, but that happens. But my experience in hospital myself, I unfortunately experienced this bedlock system that is on at the moment. And I was in the local hospital for 24 hours in emergency, and then they put me in a bed in a geriatric ward. Well, I am a geriatric, but I don't have dementia. Mm. And the majority of people in that ward at that time did have. And I, you know, the clinical care that we got was great, right? But there was this underlying sort of assumption that, you know, we're just old people. not from the staff, not from the clinical staff, but maybe from others who had, you know, things to do in the wards. And being locked in a dementia ward when you haven't got dementia can be a bit frightening, and it's isolating. This is the whole problem. It's associated not only with language but with isolation as well. You know, once you get to a certain age, it appears that the majority of the public as well seem to think, oh, well, she hasn't got long to go.
Mm.
You know, we won't worry about that. So there's only one way to get over this, and I think Rob agrees with me as to a way of doing it, is to have some public awareness campaigns about the fact that people over 65 should not just be put aside and not sort of thought of seriously. They're just there, what, biding their time. And we can do that by having programs of intergenerational activities in education. But a lot of young children never have contact with older people because it's not like it was in the olden days when your relatives lived around the corner and that kind of thing. People live in different cities. People are very mobile. A lot of children have never met their grandparents because they're still overseas and that kind of thing. So we need to persist with that kind of thing to change the cultural awareness.
Mm.
Because I have found in doing those classes that with children that they develop a great rapport with the older people who are also involved in the group.
You mentioned Rob, who's Robert Fitzgerald, the Age Discrimination Commissioner, who's also with us right now, and Patricia Sparrow, who's the CEO of the Council on the Ageing. Robert, I started by talking about Elder Speak, and we heard Val's experience just now, but that's really the tip of the iceberg for how many older people are treated in the healthcare system. Can you take me through what your new research found?
Yes, thanks very much for having us. This discussion is really important because Australia is ageing at a rapid rate. One of the most important connections for older people is the healthcare system. And so this report is really very damning of a healthcare system which does have an age lens, an age bias built into it, both in GP level and also in the acute level. This report shows pretty much what Val was saying, that people are not listened to in the decisions that affect them. They feel invisible and become voiceless in the system. Their concerns are actually diminished and attributed to being ageing. Often treatments are delayed because they don't accept what the older person is saying, and they have to go back multiple times to multiple health settings before people actually take seriously the illnesses. And often treatment options are not provided to older people, or in fact the outcomes are in fact very adverse because it's been left so long. So this affects the emotional and psychological well-being of older people who already feel a sense of vulnerability and, as Val says, a sense of invisibility, but it actually affects the treatment options that are provided or fail to be provided. And these are multiple examples, and I'm sure your audience has experienced it itself. The most important thing about this survey shows that older people do want a positive and healthy aging experience, but ageism is the absolute enemy of it. It's the very thing that destroys the opportunity to have a positive and healthy experience in aging.
You're talking about people having delayed or not being offered care, not being able to be sort of connected to their care. Are we able to quantify what the health outcomes here are?
No, it's impossible to quantify. And so this work, we did last year a research piece that looked at national and international research. And what we discovered, there's not a lot of evidence available in Australia. What we do know is from older people themselves and the peak bodies such as COTA and all those that represent older people, that this is a real experience, an adverse experience that many, many older people are experiencing in their daily lives in relation to healthcare. What we also know is that there are things we can do and we need to do to minimise this sort of ageism that takes place in the healthcare settings. And the real challenge here is that it's often quite hidden. You won't find a policy that says you should not do these treatments for a person of 75 years of age or 80. But what you do see is clinical practice that clearly shows, without any doubt at all, that ageism is the lens through which many of these conditions are being seen. And so we have to change that practice. We also have to give much greater voice to older people as they confront the healthcare system. Put very simply, we have to learn to listen to them and listen to them with real intent, not just some sort of passing regard for what they're saying.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to the Age Discrimination Commissioner, Robert Fitzgerald. You also heard from Val Fell, who's 96 years old and is on the federal government's Aged Care Council of Elders. And you haven't heard from her yet, but Patricia Sparrow, the CEO for the Council on the Ageing, is also with me. And you are blowing up the text line right now. now I'm getting so many stories. One person says, a doctor once greeted me very condescendingly with a, and how are we today? I replied, I'm fine, but I can't speak for you. Had my 75 plus assessment yesterday and was classified as cognitively intact. I'm thinking of making a badge. Another says, OMG, I turned 60 last year and have a partner in his 70s with multiple health issues. I advocate for him, but I'm often talked to like I'm a 3-year-old. Another says, I've had two different experiences with my parents. My mother saw a psychiatrist in early stages of Alzheimer's. He spoke directly to her, not to me, and he respected her. However, my father's cardiologist was very dismissive of him. He spoke to me about Dad as Dad sat right next to me and was completely cognizant. Well, Patricia Sparrow from Council of the Aging, listening to these stories, listening to the research that Robert's just detailed, does this come as a surprise to you?
Good morning, and thanks for including me in this esteemed panel of colleagues. Look, it doesn't, unfortunately. It is what we hear from older people every day. And as your listeners are actually calling in and texting in, they're reaffirming that this is all too commonplace for people. And it really does have a huge impact on them. You know, seen with my own family, seen with older people that I talk to, the everyday impacts this have of feeling invisible, not listened to, and in some ways that people don't really care and want to support you.
Ageism has a couple of different forms, doesn't it, Patricia?
It does. I mean, we talk about three forms of ageism. The first one being internalised, and it's something that we can all do is to check our own assumptions that we make about people who are older. And, you know, an example that I give, because it affects older and younger people, ageism. I mean, I was told at a young age not to let my hair go grey. I'm 62 now. I still go to the hairdresser and pay to get my hair dyed, because that stuck with me, because they said nobody will listen to a grey-haired old lady. And that actually shapes how you think about things. Another example that's in the healthcare space is, you know, from one of mine, I'll go to the doctors, and the doctor might be a very young, knowledgeable person, and I'll come out and go, well, he looked about 12. Mm-hmm. So even though we all work within it, we have these internalised assumptions about what somebody's age does, and we need to actually check our own assumptions and call them out. The second one that we see quite a lot in health and aged care, and this report that's been released today is really a seminal report to try and address some of these issues, is what we refer to as benevolent ageism. It's often not coming from a bad place. People think they're being helpful, and they will actually, as your listener said, will talk to somebody else because they think that's the right thing to do. But what it does is actually stops people from managing their own healthcare, from making their own decisions. And finally, we talk about systemic ageism, which Robert's report does cover as well, which is where things are built into a system. I think one of the good examples from the report is, you know, an MRI on your knee, which you can get if you're under 50 for no cost, but if you're over 50, it's not, it's at your own cost. So there are many things like that really impact on people. And as Robert's calling out, it's the absolute enemy of ageing positively and healthily. And that's what we want to see for everybody of every age. And if we can fix it in the system now, for every age group coming through, it will be better.
So, Robert, let's talk about what reforms you're proposing. How can we change our healthcare system to be better?
Well, we're not waiting for anything to happen. We're starting next week. From next week on, we're starting a process of workshops with frontline health workers around Australia, funded by the Federal Department of Health, Ageing and Disability. And that's an important first step, because often we find with ageism, and we know this from workshops we've run in other areas, that people are not necessarily aware that they're being ageist, and once they're aware of that, are prepared to change. The second thing is we have to actually work with healthcare providers to ensure that clinical practice does not have an inherent bias based on age. And that's a very important issue. I said to you before that there's very few guidelines that actually mention age, but we know it's in the clinical practice, so we have to change that. And the third one is a much longer term one, and that is by introducing into the training of all healthcare professionals, allied health workers, doctors and nurses, course components around ageing and the way in which you deal with older people. It's not just about the conditions that are associated with aging. It's about the way in which you treat and deal and listen to older people. Because one of the things that's very clear is that ageism has a detrimental effect on the emotional and psychological well-being of older people. And we have to stop that. So we want to do that as well. So it's about frontline training, it's about clinical practice, and it's ultimately about education of healthcare workers. The very final point is, what Val said, it's about community education. And this is really going to family members and carers who often allow the enablement of the voice of the older person to be diminished. And they've got to step back a bit. And when they're dealing with health professionals, not assume that they're going to speak on behalf of their mother or their father or their brother and sister. So that's a community-wide approach, and that's a much, much longer-term initiative.
Yeah, something we can all be part of. Robert, Patricia, Val, thank you all so much for joining me. Robert Fitzgerald is the Federal Age Discrimination Commissioner. Patricia Sparrow is the CEO of the Council on the Aging. And Val Fell is on the federal government's Aged Care Council of Elders. And I'm really loving the stories you're sharing with me of what you're doing to combat it in your own life. Eve says, whenever I take my mother to a medical appointment, I make a point of sitting back, not engaging with eye contact and holding my tongue to gently force the doctor to engage fully with my mother. I'm still there taking it all in and will ask questions if needed. Well, coming up here on Life Matters, what are 2025's rudest words?
Compelling encounters.
What's been your most confronting experience?
What would your dying wish be?
You've done your homework, haven't you?
And Lee Sales is returning as our mentor.
Compelling ideas.
There's always been disruptors.
Compelling vision.
The actual sky had flame in it.
Compelling stories.
If you can change sport, you can change the wider society.
The Assembly. Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty. I Was Actually There. And Endgame with Tony Armstrong. All these and more where it's always free, always compelling. ABC iView.
If I swore right now, would you give a f***? Would you be on the phone demanding I get kicked off the air, or would you shrug and keep sipping your coffee? New research shows the swear words that used to shock us don't anymore. They've lost their sting. Our outrage has moved on to a whole new set of forbidden words. And with me is Dr. Joshua Wedlock, a researcher with Macquarie University's Department of Linguistics. Joshua, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm great. Talk me through this research you've done.
Yeah, so what we were looking at is a broader picture. We're looking at second language speakers, but we had to get a baseline of comparison. So we looked at Australian university students and we gave them a list of 55 words, all which fall under the taboo or potentially taboo category. And we asked them to rate them from least to most severity, 1 to 7 on a Likert scale. And what we were looking at is just finding out what young Aussies think of various taboo forms of language. And that's what the research looked at.
So we probably can't say any of the words on your list on the radio. Maybe we can say one or two. You're the linguist. I'll let you be the judge of what's probably okay these days. But what you basically found was that the traditional swear words, the big four-letter words, were less offensive than they used to be.
Well, yes. What we found was that when we look at the traditional, when people think of swearing, we think of the traditional as just the four-letter words. But we found the younger generation are, I mean, to say they're not offended, that would be sort of a misstep. They're less offended, and in some cases not offended at all, than what we call IST language. So language which is put as words which attack someone on an immutable feature, such as their race, their gender, etc. So they're the ones which are completely off limits.
So less slurs, more swears.
So yes, exactly. That could be a something on a T-shirt.
Put it on a
slurs,
T-shirt.
More swears. Yeah, no, exactly, because that's what the research showed. That's what the young people are sort of reacting, you know, to. It's like, oh no, that we can't say that. We don't want to say that as well. But you know, the words which in your introduction say the F bomb, they'll throw it around, no problem.
Was that a surprise to you?
It wasn't actually a surprise. It was a welcome finding, because what the other thing we were looking at is social commentators have been saying there's a change, but there was no data in Australia really to show this was true. So that's what we wanted to look at. We wanted to look at, well, we know in certain football codes, sporting codes, any sort of any slurs will get you a bigger ban than, say, a traditional four-letter word. And on TV, et cetera, censorship. So we were just thinking, okay, we know what's out there, but let's get some data to see if it's true. And lo and behold, it stacks up. So the younger generation, slurs are completely off limits. Out of our top 20, 18 of them were, well, every slur was in the top 20, and two of the words which could be considered gendered terms against females were also in the top 20. So it's night and day.
Mm. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Joshua Wedlock from Macquarie University's Department of Linguistics about new research he's done, basically getting young people to rank the rudest words Joshua could think of. He gave them to them in a list, got them to rank them from most to least offensive. And what he found was the top 20 words or so were very much slurs. And the traditional four-letter words that we might have gone, ama, if you heard someone say a few years ago, were less offensive to those young people. One person says, I want to be like Bluey's dad Bandit and say biscuits instead of swearing, but I never effing remember. Well, someone who is key at using... taking language right up to its limits is a comedian. And with me is comedian and ABC presenter Katrina Davidson, whose voice you'll remember because she's filled in a couple of times here on Life Matters. Kat, welcome back.
Thank you, Tegan. You just wrote the title to my next festival show, Less Slurs, More Swears. That's it. It's done.
Were you surprised to hear what words we really get offended by, or are you really copying that vibe when you're up on a stage with a microphone?
No surprise here whatsoever. It's very much the younger generation are offended by things that are targeted. So a slur tends to be targeted. I think as the professor said, it's about an immutable thing about you. So it feels personal. Whereas if you drop a swear word even at someone, it's very general. So for them anyway, it's much less offensive. They rarely even hear it. I've taught before in university, taught them how to do stand-up, and I've told them, particularly at one of the clubs in Brisbane, you cannot use the C word ever. And they've done it and just not realised they've done it. They don't even hear it.
Right. Interesting. So there are still taboos with some of the traditional swear words, at least in your practice, Kat.
There are, yeah. It depends on the environment, really, because I think it does tend to be generational. The changes come over time. So if you're performing to an audience that might be Gen X and Boomer, they will still twitch, and very much so for the Boomers, if you drop one of the traditional swear words. So it's in your best interest not to, because as soon as they do that, they stop laughing. And also you don't want to, risk offending them if the joke's not strong enough to handle the offence. But if your audience is a bit younger or a bit kind of more comedy savvy, then you can say swearing-wise pretty much whatever you want, because, as I say, they don't really even hear it.
I've heard comedians say that, the big names, Steve Martin and whatnot, that swearing can be a crutch in comedy, that it's the shock value that gets people laughing awkwardly rather than you being hilariously funny. What do you reckon about that?
He's a boomer. but also, yes, but anything used repetitively or clumsily is a crutch. So, yes, swearing can fall under that category, but so can, repeating the same premise or the same theory. That can be just as boring, but a very well-placed swear word it can be delicious. It can really add that special spice that only that word can.
Joshua, I've got to come to you now on this. Is boomer a slur? Does boomer feature on your list of words? Because I know that a lot of people who fall into that category don't take kindly to being labelled in that way.
Well, here's the thing. As soon as Kat said it and then you said it, I was like, I wish I had that in, because we didn't rate it. But yes, that would fall under the category of a slur, because it's attacking someone for an immutable feature. So that is definitely, and don't say it around My father.
Interesting.
It's not going to go well.
But is it, or is it just a descriptor? It kind of depends on the way in which it's wielded, because I am a Gen X, which I guess if you were referring to that in a negative parlance could be a slur, but I'm proudly Gen X. So I think those sorts of words, I mean, there are others, you know, words describing your colour or your sexuality that that do carry more venom. So I wonder if the word boomer might depend on who said it and why.
It's interesting you talk about context, Kat, because one of the texts here says, I'm not young, but I find the C word both liberating and offensive depending on who's using it and why. When aggressive males use it, I find it repulsive. They're basically saying, this is the most horrid thing I can think of to call you. When young girls use it, it's liberating. Joshua, talk to me about context.
Yeah, context is key. And again, the listener, spot on. It depends. It's this what we call chromatic effect. So who you're with, what you're talking about, what the relationship is. So relationship is key, context is key. I was talking to someone the other day and I was in a similar situation where someone used the C-bomb with me, but in an endearing way. But if they had used it without knowing me, it would not have been so endearing. So context is absolutely key, but we also have to factor that each word has a taboo loading, which the research constantly shows that you've got to be strategic. It's not easy to swear well. So that's an interesting thing as well. So yeah, the listener is spot on that one.
So Kat, briefly, a little tiny comedy masterclass, please. If we're going to use a word that others would find offensive, probably one of the less directed ones by the sounds of it, how can we deploy it with the most splash?
I think you've got to put in your head, as the late, great Cal Wilson said, don't be a jerk. So if the word is likely to wound them or bring up something ugly, don't use it. If it's used with affection and the intention is kind, then you may just get away with it.
Good advice on all counts. Kat, Joshua, thank you both so much for joining me. Kat Davidson's a comedian and an ABC presenter, sometimes fills in for me here on Life Matters. And Dr. Joshua Wedlock is a researcher with Macquarie University's Department of Linguistics. What a cool research project. And also thank you for your very creative non-swears on the text line. My colleagues and I, says one person, work in women and children's anti-violence, and we have reclaimed the C word to describe perpetrator behaviour. Luke says, effing love this chat. Mum taught us to swear well. Now we teach her all the new swear words. Anthony says, my 85-year-old mother used to say shatterack. I have no idea what it means or where it comes from or if she invented it. And one person here calling out my dad's favourite non-swear swear word, crumbs. Well, if you like almost swears, I might recommend another ABC podcast to you, What the Duck with Anne Jones, Dr. Anne Jones. Lots of cheeky almost swears combined with fascinating nature stories. You can find What the Duck on the ABC Listen app. They did a whole series about dogs, which was wonderful. They've just released a series about mushrooms. Thank you so much for your text today. We talked earlier about ageism, especially ageism in healthcare, and I was asking for your stories, and boy, you had stories for me. One text says, the most offensive experience I had in a radiology room was the person barking at me when at the end I asked, why are you shouting at me? He looked at the wall and said, old people are deaf. Another says, darling, love. Often. At a recent specialist appointment, as I kept asking questions regarding ongoing strategies and further investigations, the response was, well, you have to die of something. We also spoke earlier in the show about pill testing. Queensland government's changed the laws so that pill testing will not be available at schools on the Gold Coast this year. One person says this abstinence approach to drug use is outdated and removed from reality. Drugs have been used in every culture for all time. People who are anti-drug don't even know where their talking points come from. Legalise, regulate and tax the common recreational drugs. Educate children on the risks. There are many overseas models for drug reform. Remove the profit incentives from criminals. Chris says the amount of government resources wasted when a young person dies from drug use is staggering. Police reports, ambulance, autopsy and mental health services needed by families afterwards. If the government won't listen to common sense to protect our young people, then look at the financial costs. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters today, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. And I will be back with you again tomorrow. Beverly Wang's having one more Friday off, and you and me will be talking about the joys of not having kids. If you're kid-free, I want to know what you love about it, or what do you think about the way that kid-free adults are portrayed in popular culture? And if you do have kids, let's talk about the fun uncles and aunts that enrich your kids' lives. I'll be taking your calls after 9 a.m. Plus, Ask Auntie and the case of the remorseful former bully. Don't forget, you can get in touch with me or the whole Life Matters team at any time. You can just email us. We are lifematters@abc.net.au. And I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.